From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with Arthur Miller, one of the American theater's most celebrated playwrights. He's just written an autobiography titled Time Bends. Also today, I talk with Pulitzer Prize-winning cartoonist Herbert Block. Since the 40s, Herb Block has drawn editorial cartoons for the Washington Post. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new recording of Mutsiko Uchida performing two Mozart piano concertos. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg tries to write a good telephone answering machine message. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. My guest is playwright Arthur Miller. There are continual revivals of his 1949 Pulitzer Prize-winning play Death of a Salesman about the self-deluding salesman Willie Loman. Dustin Hoffman and John Malkovich recently starred in a TV production. In 1983, Miller traveled to China for the premiere of the Beijing People's Theater production of Death of a Salesman. Miller's other plays include All My Sons, The Crucible, After the Fall, and A View from the Bridge. He also wrote the screenplay for the film The Misfits, which starred Marilyn Monroe, to whom he was briefly married. At the age of 72, Miller has written his autobiography. It's titled Time Bends. I spoke to Arthur Miller earlier today from the NPR Bureau in Los Angeles. Over the years, many people have told him that Willie Loman in Death of a Salesman reminded them of their fathers. I asked Miller if Loman was based on his father.
Oh, no, my father was quite a different fellow. It was rather based on a group, maybe, of people, including myself. But my father was a far more realistic person than Willie Loman.
Did you have relatives who were salesmen?
Many, yeah, and friends. And it seems to me the whole United States is engaged in selling. But as it turns out, over the years, most of the world recognizes what's at the bottom of that idea, namely that Willie is trying to become great without being great, and which is what most of us are doing or dreaming about doing. So the selling part of it is rather minimally significant, I would think.
Your father made a lot of money in the 20s in the coat business, and then he lost a lot of that money during the Depression. Did that sudden turnaround in your family's fate stay with you? Did you always feel through your life that any good luck that came along could quickly be undermined by bad luck?
Well, it's even worse than luck. Luck is arbitrary. The idea in the Depression was that bad times were not arbitrary, they were inevitable. And this was the common wisdom of the time, that the country had reached some kind of an end to a what was thought to be an unbroken rising line starting back in the American Revolution, maybe. None of us was particularly interested in remembering that there had been other depressions. Of course, there was never one that widespread and that profound and that long-lasting.
Your father was in business. I think some of your uncles were in business. You became a playwright. Were you determined to stay out of the business world?
Well, it was determined for me since I never could add very well or multiply or subtract. And if you don't do those things, you can't be in business. And my temperament was completely opposite to a businessman's temperament. I could easily be distracted by some entertaining idea or something that amused me. And businessmen have to be very disciplined people. They have to put out of their minds everything that's really interesting and stick with money-making, which I could do for maybe 5 minutes, but not longer. So it was determined beforehand that I would never be in business.
In your autobiography, you wrote that you really learned a lot about casting, watching Ilya Kazan interview actors for your play All My Sons. What did you learn from the way he went about casting for that play?
Well, he... It's a little bit... I suppose the analogy is a clinical psychologist, in fact. At the time, he knew how to evince from an actor whose work he didn't know reactions to questions which would show whether he had a sense of humor, for example, whether he was ironical, whether he was able to relax. Now, some, as it turned out, of course, most of the casting of the major parts in that play were people who he'd seen act before or knew as a member of the group theater. And so we were basically looking for the young woman in the play who was required a lot of interviews. He was able to form a subjective and objective impression rather quickly. And I think that was very cute on his part.
You wrote that during a rehearsal, Kazan pressed Carl Malden to his emotional limits. Well, what exactly did he do to push him like that? And
well,
why did he do it?
He wanted indignation and anger, and he wanted him to come on at a full pitch. In other words, not come on and gradually build up some kind of anger, but have it off stage before he got there. And Carl, being a very willing fellow, kept steaming himself up off stage and getting furious at something or other, and finally charged onto the stage and stood there swaying, and he'd managed to get himself so dizzy that he was near collapse and had to sit down in the middle of this anger and ask for help. These were tactics that I'm sure have been used before and since, but they were interesting for me for the first time.
Writer Arthur Miller is my guest. He's just written an autobiography titled Time Bends. Now, about Death of a Salesman, you write that you think it was frequently played with too much empathy, not enough irony and distance. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, it wasn't that it was played that way. It was that the play was a tremendous shock to that audience, I believe. And it still is in some productions. But they weren't at all prepared for it. And my reaction was that I, after a few weeks of watching, occasionally I'd drop into the theater once a week or so to see how it was going. I wanted simply to write a tougher play because the times were changing, and as 1950 was coming around. And I wanted to confront people with stuff that I saw in the society which was being ignored. And I came up with The Crucible, finally, which was a much harder-edged play. It's not that I didn't want to move people, but I wanted them to keep their awareness intact as to what Willie's failures were as a human being, and not simply to go down with him in a veil of tears. I was mistaken somewhat, I think, because people did understand far more than I gave them credit for at the time.
I read somewhere that several corporations invited you to speak to their sales managers after Death of a Salesman opened.
Yeah, I was supposed to be a sales expert. Of course, I've never sold anything. I don't know how I would start to do it. And I managed to turn down those invitations, although had I had more chutzpah, I probably should have done it.
To tell them what?
Well, I should have addressed these salesmen and told them how to do it so that they could commit suicide later. But it was that silly. But I managed not to do it. I should add, I don't know why it crosses my mind, that, you know, in China now, I was just talking to a newspaper correspondent who just come back a few days ago. And the salesman plays there all the time. And I asked him whether they had gotten used to it now, because when I did it a couple of years ago there, it was a bombshell. They'd never seen a play like that. And he said, well, now, all the enterprises in China, a lot of them now are new, and they're set up by individuals. He said there are hundreds of salesmen all over the place. China is one mass of salesmanship now. They're running from one place to another, selling each other stuff. And so the play has now become part of their problem as to how to make life real. You see, when there's a surplus and you have to sell it, life becomes a little bit metaphorical and loses its touch with the earth.
Yeah.
And I guess it's the cost of technology.
You were married to Marilyn Monroe for several years. The first time you met her, you described her in your book as being ludicrously provocative. I think about what an unusual couple that you made, you the intellectual playwright and she the sex goddess. Did you think of yourselves as kind of balancing each other in a way?
Well, we were in effect, you could say, unifying two sides of humanity, if you want to use some highfalutin language. I didn't see her as a sex goddess anyway. She wasn't one then. She became one after her death, basically, and in the last few years of her life. But early on, she was just a young woman trying to get a job as an actress and trying to improve herself as an actress. So she was hardly a goddess. She was powerless, if truth were known.
Well, you told her that you thought she was the saddest girl that you'd ever known, and she said that you were the only person who'd ever said that about her. What made you say that?
Well, I just sensed that she had very deep problems and that she was basically in mourning for something. Of course, in our terms today, Marilyn was an abused child, and a badly abused child. And as we know now, such people carry their wounds through their lives. And in some cases, they get worse as they grow older.
You wrote the screenplay for The Misfits, in which Marilyn Monroe co-starred with Clark Gable, directed by John Huston. She had been studying with Lee Strasberg. And you thought that the acting lessons she was taking from him were becoming a bad influence on her. It was encouraging her to improvise in the script of The Misfits, and you thought that that wasn't good. Would you explain?
Well, Strasberg's view was that, at least as Marilyn understood it, and I think she understood what he was saying to her, was that the words were far less important than the emotion that the actor brought to the moment. So this led people to misunderstand that the language on the page, like the notes that a musician has to play, were the vehicles for his emotion. As a consequence, it wasn't just Marilyn, it was a number of other actors that I've had to deal with in the past, would scramble around searching, groping for words that they should have easily been able to handle. And meantime, were trying to maintain an emotional life at the same moment. This makes it doubly difficult. Instead of absorbing the words and forgetting about them, they never did learn them. They were in revolt against the words. And, of course, when you asked them, it wasn't, again, not merely Marilyn, but many others, what are you going to do when you do Chekhov, where everybody knows the speeches? Or, for that matter, if you're going to do Death of a Salesman, in which everybody knows the speeches, are you going to improvise new speeches? Well, there was never a satisfactory answer to this, and I found it was a very misleading way of directing actors. I thought it was perverse.
Well, with Marilyn Monroe and The Misfits, it must have been especially aggravating to you because, A, you were married, and B, it was your screenplay that she was improvising on.
Well, no, it wasn't that. It's that it holds everything up. You cannot improvise that way. I have one actor improvising and everybody else sticking to the script, obviously. The other actors are waiting for their cues, and if the cue doesn't come, they are inconvenienced, aren't they? How do they know when to speak?
You've written about Marilyn Monroe that she saw men as boys with immediate... that she saw men as boys with immediate needs that it was her place to fill. That made me think about the kind of jealousy you must have had to control when you were married to her.
Not at all. I didn't feel anything like that.
The only other question I wanted to ask you was what the relationship taught you about real life versus movie life, or the difficulties of life in the spotlight in America.
We tend to exploit people in the movies and to make them into non-human figures. And it's a form of disrespect, actually, for the most part, but it's disguised. Since we don't know, for the most part, a good actor from a bad one, it all becomes a question of personalities. And the art, whether it be the art of acting or the art of directing or anything else, goes by the boards for the most part. There are better views than that now, I think, than there used to be. There are more better-equipped critics in the movies now than there used to be. But this whole thing is, this personality cult is a cheap and easy way to get out of having to make any kind of aesthetic judgments.
My guest is Arthur Miller. He's written a new autobiography titled Time Bends. Arthur Miller's plays include Death of a Salesman, All My Sons, and The Crucible. We'll talk some more about his life and about theater after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
Arthur Miller is my guest. You were called to testify before UAC, the House on American Activities Committee. And it's interesting to me, you didn't take the Fifth. You refused to answer questions about other people and about whether they were communists or not, or whether they attended certain meetings. But you didn't take the Fifth like some people did who didn't want to respond to the committee. And I was wondering what your strategy was, how you conceived of your strategy.
Well, by the time I was called, certain standards had been forced upon the committee by the courts, particularly that they were not supposed to be calling people without cause. Previously, they could simply pick you out of your studio and decide that you were going to go in front of the committee if they thought there was some publicity to be gained from it. And they need give no reason for calling you, excepting a perfectly rhetorical one. Now, as a result of various cases that had been fought and won, particularly by Joseph Rao, my lawyer, who had been the head of the American for Democratic Action, and a strong fighter for civil liberties, they had to provide you might call it a pretext, or it could be a genuine reason for calling a person. I should add that a day before I was to testify in Washington, the chairman of the committee, Congressman Walter of Pennsylvania, had my lawyer contacted and was informed that if Marilyn Monroe would take a photograph with him, he would cancel the hearing. When that was refused by me and Marilyn, he proceeded to paint me as an imminent danger to the Republic. The cynicism of this whole thing is breathtaking.
You had some friends who did name names to the House on American Activities Committee, and one of your good friends who named names was Ilya Kazan. Now, he told you he was just confirming names, that he wasn't offering new names. But how did you react to his cooperation, and were you ever able to become close again after whatever separation that difference caused?
Well, I was, like a lot of other people, we had positioned ourselves in opposition to the committee. And when he did that, I was shocked, and I couldn't work with him for a while, for some years. For, as a matter of fact, let's see, that would have been about 7 years.
In 1965, you accepted the chairmanship of the International PEN organization, P-E-N, which is the International
Right.
Organization of Writers. Were you inspired to do that because, well, why were you inspired to accept that position, which I know would take away time from your writing?
Well, quite simply, the organization was foundering, as it was presented to me by the British, who were the center of the organization at that time, and to a degree still are. And they needed somebody whose name was known and who would show that live writers with real typewriters were interested in the organization. And what the organization was primarily about at that time was to try to save people in the Eastern European dictatorships, which it was managing to do in a faltering way because it did not have at that time the support of all the Western writers. And I took it over, and I'm glad to say that the organization in a few years became extremely active and attracted a lot of wonderful people in it and is now a very strong organization with a big American membership and does a hell of a job with preserving the rights of writers all over the world.
In 1986, you went to the Soviet Union, and there you met Mikhail Gorbachev, who shook hands with you and said to you, "I know all of your plays." But you've said that your plays have been censored during a period in the Soviet Union. Well, which was that period, and which plays were censored?
In 68, they had a production in rehearsal of Incident of Vichy, which is a play about the Jews in southern France during World War II. And the night before it was to open to the public, it was closed down by the government. It was part of the Brezhnev time, I guess. And they were having trouble, as they put it, with the Jews then. But it was also that I was, by that time, had become very vociferous in criticizing certain treatment they were meeting out to writers. So that I became a stinker for, well, that's till about last year, in fact, from 68. And that same production, Things Move Slowly in Russia, reopened about 8 months ago, and is running in Moscow now. Of Incident of Vichy. So it was a matter of roughly 9 years that my stuff was not done in Russia.
Do you go to Broadway much anymore? Do you go to many shows?
Not much, but I never did go very much. Unfortunately, Broadway now has practically ruled out any kind of straight plays, whether they're acceptable to the critics or not. The audience has been dispersed, which was perfectly predictable. Indeed, in 52, I was then a member of the board of the Dramatists Guild, and I tried to create a conference between the producers, the directors, the actors, the scene movers and builders and so forth, and the writers, to try to get everybody to take a little less money so that we could save and reduce the price of the ticket, because I felt we were slowly but surely going to block out the teacher, the student, the gut of the audience that was possible in New York City. Well, nobody was really that interested enough to do anything about it, and we never did anything about it. And now, effectively, they have knocked those people out of the audience. So how this will ever be cured, I don't know. I don't think it is yet taken seriously enough. They still go on saying that if a good play comes along and it's a hit, they're going to make a lot of money on it. And, of course, once in a while this happens, and it's enough to justify the idea that nothing is fundamentally askew. The thing is sick. It's been getting ill for years, and the basic problems are well known, but nobody's interested enough to do anything about them. Namely, that we have one newspaper in New York that matters as far as it is concerned, so it's all but a monopoly. There is no consensus of critical opinion. Two, the price of the ticket is high because of greed in part, and partly because it's totally chaotic in its organization. And finally, there has been no effort to organize an audience. An audience doesn't just show up for play, or it just has to, people have to be somehow drawn to the theater. I repeat that the Lincoln Center is trying to do that, and they have to a degree succeeded. But of course, you can get in there for less than $10. And they contact students, they contact faculties, they try to engage the public in the theater as a cultural event instead of simply appealing to the people as a for another form of television so that they can cast plays with good actors, not necessarily television stars. People are now going to Broadway shows because there is a star. It's always the sign of a decayed theater when that happens.
Can I just ask you really briefly what you thought of the television production of the Dustin Hoffman, John Malkovich production of
Death
of a Salesman?
I thought it was a very fine... that play is very difficult to put on film. We haven't time here to discuss some of the metaphysics involved, because it is a kind of metaphysical problem. But... they came as close as you could come, I think, to solving some of those problems. And I thought it was a very moving performance.
We only have a few seconds. Let me just ask you this kind of quickly. You once said that, Willie Loman in Death of a Salesman says, I still feel kind of temporary about myself. And you once said that summed up your condition through life. Is that right?
Yeah, I think so. It's that I'm open to tomorrow morning. I don't feel settled in any way. I think that it's very difficult in the 20th century to continue feeling if you think everything is foreclosed. Life is open-ended. Anything can happen. And I wouldn't say prepared for it, but I'm sort of looking over my shoulder. In that sense, temporary about myself, yes. Life goes on developing even when you get to be an ancient mariner like me. It's different from year to year, month to month.
Well, Arthur Miller, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you.
Thank you.
My guest has been playwright Arthur Miller. His new autobiography, Time Bends, has just been published by Grove Press. He spoke to us from the NPR Bureau in Los Angeles. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, we'll feature a concert of standards with jazz singer Susanna McCorkle, so I hope you can join us.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks, featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, I speak with political cartoonist Herbert Block. Herb Block, as he's known, is now in his fifth decade as cartoonist for the Washington Post. Along the way, he's won three Pulitzer Prizes and has caricatured every president from Herbert Hoover to Ronald Reagan. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new recording of Mozart piano concertos performed by Mitsuko Uchida with the English Chamber Orchestra conducted by Jeffrey Tate. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg tries to figure out the perfect answering machine message. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Mara Liasson in Washington. Chicago Mayor Harold Washington died today. He suffered a heart attack in his office at City Hall. Washington's press secretary, Alton Miller, made the announcement this afternoon.
It is my sad responsibility to let you know that Mayor Washington was pronounced dead this afternoon at 1:36.
Washington never regained consciousness after suffering the heart attack. Washington was serving his second term of office and was Chicago's first black mayor. He was first elected in 1983 in a bitter race against then-incumbent Mayor Jane Byrne. The city council will choose a successor to Washington. In the meantime, Vice Mayor David Orr will serve as acting mayor. The Pentagon today sent a special unit to Atlanta to help put down rioting by Cuban detainees at a federal prison. Pentagon spokesman Major Randy Morger says the unit will serve in an advisory capacity.
At the request of the Department of Justice, the Department of Defense has provided some military experts to give technical advice to the civilian authorities in the Atlanta area. We won't comment on the role of those advisors or the nature of the advice they're providing.
Federal officials say they plan no military actions, which could endanger the 93 hostages at the Atlanta prison. The Cuban detainees are fighting possible deportation. Meanwhile, in Oakdale, Louisiana, where Cuban inmates have also rioted, detainees say they might accept deportation to a country other than Cuba. Inmates at Oakdale are holding more than 20 hostages. Secretary of State George Shultz today announced that as soon as the Intermediate-Range Nuclear Weapons Treaty is signed, deployment of U.S. cruise missiles in Europe will stop. Technically, the U.S. doesn't have to stop deployment until after the treaty is ratified by the Senate. Today, Shultz said he is confident the treaty will be ratified. The INF agreement needs a two-thirds vote to be accepted. Today, Vietnam turned over the remains of five Americans reported as missing in action during the Vietnam War. A transport plane carrying 12 U.S. officials landed in Hanoi this morning to pick up the remains. The names of the deceased are being withheld pending final identification of the remains in Honolulu. There are 2,413 Americans still listed as missing in action in Indochina. New York's highest court today struck down a state regulation banning smoking in public places. It had been considered one of the toughest such rules in the country. NPR's Mike Schuster reports.
The New York State Public Health Council enacted the smoking ban last February, and if it had been implemented, it would have prohibited smoking in many public places, schools, hospitals, stores, auditoriums, and taxicabs, and in many restaurants and workplaces. But before the ban went into effect last spring, a restaurant owner near Albany brought suit against the measure in court. Two lower courts ruled against the restrictions, and today New York's highest court agreed that the Public Health Council had usurped the power of the state legislature. The 6-1 court decision said that only the legislature had the power to promulgate such a comprehensive code governing tobacco smoking. The court did not dispute the evidence that secondhand smoke is a health hazard, which had been the basis for enacting the smoking ban. I'm Mike Schuster in New York.
In Haiti, pre-election violence continues. Today, two more people were killed, bringing the death toll this week to five. One man was clubbed to death by a vigilante group, which claimed he was a member of the Tonton Macoute, the security police used by deposed dictator Jean-Claude Duvalier. The other man was killed in an area where armed men had been seen driving in jeeps and shooting into the air. The elections, the first in Haiti in 30 years, are scheduled for November 29th. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission today cleared the way for low-power operations at the Seabrook, New Hampshire nuclear power plant. Today's vote reversed an earlier NRC ruling that blocked operations at Seabrook. Stock prices were lower today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell more than 16 points to close at 1946.45. I'm Mara Liasson in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Some people think that Mozart's greatest contribution to music is his series of later piano concertos. Our classical music critic Lord Schwartz says technically they're not the hardest music, but stylistically, these works demand an elegance of style that doesn't trivialize them. Lloyd is excited about a new Mozart concerto series by the Japanese pianist Mitsuko Uchida, but he has some reservations.
Mozart lovers have been ecstatic about the sonata recordings by Mitsuko Uchida that have been coming out on Philips over the past few years. Here was a young pianist of unusual refinement and dexterity, one whose delicate touch didn't diminish Mozart to music box triviality. Now Uchida has begun a series of Mozart concertos with the English Chamber Orchestra under Geoffrey Tate. This young British conductor's work at the Metropolitan Opera, especially Mozart, and his Mozart and Haydn symphony recordings on Angel have impressed both critics and people who love music. Their new Philips album includes two of the most sublimely beautiful Mozart piano concertos of all, number 22 in E-flat and number 23 in A. These heavenly works are not completely unclouded. Their slow movements, with some of Mozart's most astonishing writing for winds, are moments of stillness, of reflection, of quiet contemplation. In Keats's Ode on Melancholy, the poet discovers that joy's grape can't be tasted unless it's crushed against his palate fine. Mozart, too, knows that in the very heart of joy there is sorrow. He shares this intuitive premonition that on earth, the more intense the joy, the sooner it will end. You can hear something of this, for example, in the opening of the slow movement of the 23rd concerto, the only slow movement in all of Mozart's piano concertos marked Adagio. Some of this momentary melancholy even invades the high spirits of the fast movements. You can hear a little of it, for example, in the heartbreaking little minuet that interrupts the last movement of the 22nd concerto, which Mozart probably wrote several years after he sketched out the 23rd concerto.
Thank you.
These Mozart performances by Mitsuko Uchida and Jeffrey Tate are so elegant, so intelligent, that I'm reluctant to express any reservations. Maybe the performers know too much. There's an element of innocence or mystery that I wish I could hear more of. They make me feel that what they know, they've learned very well. But don't the very greatest performances convince you that the performers are also discovering something, that they themselves are living through and feeling what they play? It's clear that on this new record, Uchida and Tate know that beneath Mozart's gorgeous surfaces lie tears. What I'm not sure about is how many of those tears they are actually shedding themselves.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix and teaches at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. He reviewed a recording of Mozart's 22nd and 23rd piano concertos performed by Mitsuko Uchida on the Philips label. This is Fresh Air. The great political dramas of our time, World War II, McCarthyism, the nuclear arms race, the war in Vietnam, Watergate, the Iran-Contra scandal, have all been the subjects of editorial cartoons signed Herblock. For the past 41 years, he's turned out 5 cartoons a week for the Washington Post. Herbert Block had already had 1 Pulitzer Prize under his belt when he joined the Post in 1946. He has since won 2 more and shared in a 4th. Herbert Block has collected some of his most recent cartoons for his 10th book, Herblock at Large. The cover has one of his cartoons of Ronald Reagan.
The cover cartoon is a picture of President Reagan looking very, very thoughtful and a little puzzled. And a gentleman who might be a psychologist, doesn't say, is talking to him. And he's saying, "Let's go back a little. You remember taking the oath of office?"
It's interesting. You frequently draw President Reagan as helpless and kind of confused, puzzled and helpless.
A good deal of the time, he does look a little little out of it in some of the cartoons.
The way you draw President Reagan is an interesting comparison to the way you used to draw President Nixon. You always had a 5 o'clock shadow on his face.
Yeah, well, you know, they look different, and not only in the face, but the posture and so on. And Nixon always looked pretty shifty, and Reagan doesn't. Reagan oftentimes says things that are not so, or makes up stories, but he always comes across looking very sincere.
Was there any president that was especially good from your vantage point as a cartoonist, especially good to caricature and to do cartoons about?
It doesn't make any difference, really, what they look like. It's a matter of what they do. I don't really care whether they have big ears or buck teeth or what, you know. It's anybody you draw often enough, any president, you're certainly going to do quite a bit. You get your own formula for drawing that person. What I'm interested in, you know, is what they do.
One of your running characters is a walking, talking nuclear bomb. You have a cartoon with this character in your new book. Would you describe that cartoon?
Yes, it's this big bomb is celebrating 40 years. It's like a large birthday cake with bombs as candles on it. And it says U.S., USSR, 50,000 warheads. That's the total. And it has these little bombs in baby carriages being pushed around by other countries, smaller countries, more countries with nuclear potential. And the big bomb is saying, "But I'm happiest about the grandchildren."
Would you describe how you draw that Mr. Bomb character?
Well, he's just a tall bomb with a very grim face and looks unshaven, looks pretty tough. And I don't know how you describe him outside of that. When I started doing him, he was just a little more than the size of a person, and he progressively got bigger and bigger, especially when we went from the A-bomb to the H-bomb.
Let's talk about your drawing style. You went to art school. Did that help you actually express yourself visually when you were doing caricatures and cartoons?
I don't know that it did. I would say I've learned a good deal on the job, really, you know. And one of the great things about school newspapers is it gives you a chance to see your stuff in print and see how it reproduces, how it looks, and so on.
What made you decide to become a political cartoonist?
Well, I've always been interested in it. I was also interested in writing. I had a brother who was a lifetime reporter in Chicago. He got me a job as a reporter. But I found that cartooning came easy, and easier than chasing fire engines. And So I drew for suburban school papers, suburban newspapers, and so on, and finally got a job on a Chicago newspaper doing daily cartoons.
When did you start using, and how did you come up with the idea to use the signature of Herb Locke?
Well, that began really before it was. It began before the cartoons. The newspapers used to use have editorial page columns, which were contributors' columns. There was FPA, Franklin P. Adams in New York, and RHL Richard Little in the Chicago Tribune, and so on. And it was Little's column called A Line, A Type or Two that I used to contribute paragraphs to. And for some reason in those days, everyone seemed to think they had to have a trick name. They'd either spell their name backwards or adopt some romantic name if they wrote poetry or so on. And I was thinking of a name to sign my little paragraphs. And my father suggested, why don't you combine your first and last names? And so I did that. And then later, when I went to get a job on the Chicago Daily News drawing cartoons, they felt that name was recognizable from the paragraphs I had written. I just kept it.
I have to tell you that when I was growing up and reading your cartoons, I thought your name was Herb Locke.
Well,
I'm sure a lot of other people did, too.
I get mail addressed that way, among other things, and it's perfectly natural for people to think that, and it's, you know, nobody's to blame except me.
There was a Newsweek article in 1980 about how the art of political cartooning had changed, and it credited you with really changing political cartooning from what it used to be as represented by a drawing of a hammer labeled Soviet aggression hitting a thumb labeled Hungary. Does that sum up to you what the state of political cartooning used to be?
Well, there used to be a lot more labels than there are now. And in fact, I used to use more labels than I do now, too. But I think, you know, the readers have become more sophisticated. And cartoons now, you know, have fewer labels. And also in the cartoons, what I tried to do was to combine a certain amount of humor with a viewpoint to say something and to try to do it in an amusing way. And, if that's my contribution, okay.
You were cartooning during the communist baiting period of the McCarthy era, and I think that you were credited with coining the term McCarthyism.
That's right. Yes.
How did you do that?
Well, it began in a cartoon that I did. It showed a bunch of tar barrels, and the prominent Republican candidates, and pushing the elephant toward this. Tar barrel, and I think he said something like, "You mean I'm supposed to stand on that?" And for the tar barrel, I kind of thought about, you know, it needed some kind of a label, and I thought, well, it's not McCarthy, and you know, what do you call it? I thought, well, McCarthyism would describe it, and so I used that, and that's where the word apparently originated.
Have you ever gotten angry responses from any of the politicians who you've criticized in your cartoons?
I don't recall any from the politicians themselves. And, you know, interestingly enough, when I do hear from some of those I've criticized, it's generally to ask for a copy of the drawing, something like that. And the angriest mail, of course, comes from their supporters, people, not from the politicians themselves.
Well, I think even a critical cartoon still appeals to a side of a politician's vanity.
Well, I think so. And, there are also some politicians who just want to collect everything about themselves, all whether cartoons are favorable or unfavorable.
When you're upset about the state of American politics, does it seem to you like a real comedy, or do you find yourself getting really worked up and angry in spite of the fact that you're able to make jokes about it?
Well, sometimes you can't help but get angry. You know, I look at the paper at night. Sometimes I get the early edition of the morning paper and look at it and think, you know, they can't do that sort of thing. And sometimes in I draw several sketches generally before I do a finished drawing, and sometimes you start out with an idea that's just plain angry, and you kind of keep working on it until you get a little fun in it or get it presented in a way that's a little more interesting and isn't just saying, you know, they're no good, something of that kind.
You've caricatured so many people during your career. Have you ever caricatured yourself?
Yes, I have. I think a couple of times for magazine pieces or something of that kind. I've also occasionally put myself in the cartoon as a, you know, when you want a character who's looking quizzical or asking something, or for some reason, just sometimes it's fun to put myself in.
Syndicated political cartoonist Herb Locke. His new book, Herb Locke at Large, is published by Pantheon. You're listening to Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Renee Montaigne co-hosts the program, and she's joining us from Washington. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
What story are you following?
Terry, Chicago's Mayor Harold Washington was struck with a massive heart attack. We'll have a story on that and also a profile of the mayor. Also, updates on the prison takeovers by Cuban inmates in Oakdale, Louisiana, and Atlanta, Georgia, and a pre-Thanksgiving look at the occupational hazards faced by turkey workers. And that's a real story. There are hazards. But a tongue-in-cheek call to a Butterball turkey hotline. Also, we will have a report on katydids. A biologist has discovered some katydids that don't. They don't sing, that is. They dance.
Thanks, Renee. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Many people spend a lot of time producing elaborate, personalized messages for their telephone answering machines. Our language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg says maybe we haven't thought enough about how we get our messages across.
This is Jeff Nunberg. I'm not here now, but you can leave a message when you hear the beep.
Over the millennia, human language has slowly evolved into the perfect instrument for face-to-face talk. The primacy of this sort of communication is built into the structure of the language in all those devices like this and that, here and now, and present and past tenses, which anchor an utterance to its context. Using such terms, we have been able to express our every thought to anyone standing in immediate earshot. What are you doing with that rock? Or, I'll have another haunch of that mammoth now. Then technology altered the context. The speaker and hearer no longer had to be in the same place at the same time. Hence, for example, the problem that I now have to face when I want to record a message on my answering machine. How do I use now and here when I'm recording a message that's designed to be listened to sometime in the future, at which time I'll be somewhere else? I'm not here now? That can't be right. Of course I'm here now. I'm here now is the only eternal verity, the only thing I could state with certainty if I were to wake up with a case of total amnesia in the middle of a trackless desert somewhere. I suppose what I really should say is something like, I won't be there then. That's what I'd say, after all, if somebody proposed delivering my new couch next Thursday when I'm at work. Except that when I record the message, I don't really know when then is going to be, so how do I know I'll be out? What's more, my caller's liable to think that there means the place he's calling from, not the place I'm recording at. And of course I'm not there. If I were, he wouldn't have to place the call in the first place. So if I want to be both clear and logical, I have to say something like, this is Jeff Nunberg. If you're hearing this, I won't be where you're calling to at the time you call there, but you can leave a message. But now I've got technical problems, especially since I've only got a 15-second tape loop. And besides, I'm still not out of the logical woods. What about that "This is Jeff Nunberg" bit? What the caller is hearing is not me in the flesh, after all, but the recording I've left on the box. If I'm really going to be precise about things, I should say, "This is a recording of Jeff Nunberg," or maybe, "Hi, this is my voice speaking." People try other ruses to get around these problems. One thing you hear a lot is, "Hi, I'm sorry I wasn't in when you called, but you can leave a message when you hear the beep." But grammatically, this one is a complete catastrophe. Here you are, recording a message on Tuesday, and using the past tense to refer to a call that may not occur till Thursday. What logic would require here is the good old future perfect, as in, "Hi, I will surely be sorry not to have been in when you will have called, but you will have been able to leave a message once you have heard the beep. You will have had 30 seconds. I actually had this on my machine for a while, but I found that my messages were suffering a perceptible decline in class. One thing I've had to learn to live with in my line of work is that not everybody values precise communication the way I do. If you call me nowadays, this is what you'll hear.
Nunberg's place, nobody home, leave a message.
Oh, I know it's a little brusque, but at least you can't fault the grammar. Maybe it would help if I ran a little Mozart in the background. On behalf of Fresh Air, this is Jeff Nunberg. This has been Jeff Nunberg. This will have been Jeff Nunberg, wishing you good morning, good afternoon, or good night, as the case may be.
And who is Jeff Nunberg? He is a linguist associated with the Center for the Study of Language and Information at Stanford University. Here's a look at tomorrow's Fresh Air. Tomorrow, I'll speak with film sound designer Alan Splett. He created the eerie sounds for the David Lynch films Blue Velvet, Eraserhead, and Elephant Man. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker will review Brian Ferry's new album, Bête Noire, and film critic Stephen Schiff will review Sammy and Rosie Get Laid. It's written by Hanif Qureshi and directed by Stephen Frears, the same team that made the surprise hit My Beautiful Laundrette. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton are the production assistants. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.